streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob? Well, all
right. Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year. You dig? Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
If you've ever visited a museum, enjoyed an opera house, studied at a university, worked at a think tank, an NGO, or gone to the hospital, or even if you've ever donated to a good cause, your life has been impacted by philanthropy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Subscribe to our series on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. I'm honored to welcome Paul Vallely to the show today to talk about his recent book, Philanthropy, From Aristotle to Zuckerberg. Paul Vallely is an award-winning journalist and commentator on religion, society, and politics. In 2006, he was honored with the coveted British CMG Award in recognition of his services to journalism and to the developing world. Vallely is the editor of The New Politics, Catholic Social Teaching for the 21st Century, and has advised Catholic bishops of England and Wales. Paul Vallely, welcome to the podcast.
It's very good to be here.
Tell us about the two foundational visions of philanthropy, Jerusalem and Athens, the Jewish view on which Christian and Muslim views are based, and the Greek and Roman views.
Well, philanthropy has really intertwined those two traditions for over two millennia. The word philanthropy is Greek, and it comes from philos, love, anthropos, mankind, lover of mankind. And in the heyday of 4th century BCE Athens, we had a situation where there was something called liturgia, which is where the word liturgy comes from. And it was a system which was used to persuade members of the wealthy elite to choose to finance some public cause. It might be something small like funding a play or sending a team of athletes to the Olympic Games, or it could be something big like building a temple or a warship. And the prominent citizens sought to outdo one another in the extravagance of their gifts to show the superiority of their own civic virtue. And so you had this kind of philanthropy, which was about power and prestige. It was lavished according to the personal preferences of the donors, and it was essentially about the rich rather than the poor. Now, in the same historical period, Judaism brought a revolution to this notion of philanthropy. I don't have to tell you from the start, you know, the book of Genesis, every man and woman, Adam and Eve, they're made in the image of God. But what a lot of people don't realize is that this idea of everybody being made in the image of God was absolutely revolutionary at the time in a Middle Eastern world where only kings and emperors and pharaohs were gods. And something else was new in Judaism. God was spoken of as amongst many other things, the God of the poor. That was never a phrase applied to any Greek or Roman God. And Judaism, with its vision of the stranger, the widow, the orphan, being repeatedly seeking, singled out as deserving of charity, comes from this idea that God had been generous to humankind, and so in a kind of human echo of that, men and women had a responsibility to be generous to one another. So where the Greeks were talking about social hierarchy, like social cement, social cohesion, we might call it today, for the Jews, it was this idea of a relationship between the individual, God, and the entire community, a very communitarian philanthropy philosophy. And that really seeped into Christianity and then Islam, and it dominated the Western world until the 14th century. It all changed with a pandemic, interestingly enough, the Black Death.
Well, even long before we get to the Middle Ages and the Black Death, you explain at length in the book the observation that gift giving, gift exchange has been studied by anthropologists and sociologists in many times and places and cultures. And in many of them, or most of them, gifts are a sign of status as well as concern for others. So is there a confounding between gifts and charity or philanthropy?
Well, one of the interesting things about philanthropy is that it has been many things in different periods. It's been a form of social control. It's been a form of religious altruism and everything in between. It's been about enhancing the status of the donor. But it's rarely one thing only. There's often mixed motives in philanthropy. So you get, as in Judaism, this notion, tzedakah is both charity and justice. That's a very kind of social justice end of the model. But at the other end is the idea of, I suppose, the most venal end is reputation laundering, where somebody fairly cynically gives philanthropically in order to draw attention away from the fact that they may be kind of indulging in ruthless business practices or downright theft. So it's not usually possible to say that any one example of philanthropy is only one thing. It's got this mixture in it.
There's also been some criticism of philanthropists who are criticized as giving because it makes them feel good. But of course, now we know from research in the human brain that, in fact, giving does give us a kick, a high, that when you give, the part of your brain that delivers pleasure, the dopamine, the same part that's activated if you take cocaine, gets elevated. That warm glow of giving is, in fact, biological.
Yeah, well, there's scientific proof of that, but of course, religions and philosophers have known that for ages. You know, it's more blessed to give than to receive. And if you talk to modern day philanthropists, they will tell you how much they get out of it. It's not a one way process. They're enriched by it personally. And if you look at somebody like Chuck Feeney, who was the role model for Bill Gates. Feeney in the 80s made billions from duty-free shopping, and he gave away a lot of his money undercover. So he was called the James Bond of philanthropy because he did it without any publicity. But eventually, when his cover was broken by a court case, he was enlisted by Bill Gates and Warren Buffett to talk to other billionaires about what they should do. And Feeney's overall driving impulse was to say, look, try it. You'll enjoy it. It's good. You get something from it.
Yes, your book is punctuated by very interesting interviews with the prominent philanthropists and others. Can you expand on the comment that one of your interviewees, the late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, said? I'll read you the quote. I've always found that philanthropy is constitutive of the third space called civil society, the bit that isn't the economy and isn't the state. Philanthropy, by and large, establishes an I-thou relationship, a personal relationship. Government must, of its essence, be impartial, be impersonal. What did he mean by that?
He meant that there is in life, especially in the modern times, we've got this polarization. There's about kind of binary view that the problems can be solved by the market. That's the kind of the neoconservative view, and then they've got the socialist, the extreme socialist view, is that the state can deal with everything. Well, we've learned over the centuries that neither of those is right. Neither the state nor the market is the answer to everything. So where is this intermediate space? Well, Edmund Burke, the philosopher of early conservatism, talked about little platoons in society, and these were the organizations, for everything from the trade unions, the churches, the synagogues, the everything down to the parent teacher association at the school, tennis clubs, golf clubs, lobby groups, political party, anything that kind of stood to actually amplify the voice of the individual or to allow the individual to interact with other people. And these little platoons are what to make life human scale. And where we have that I-thou relationship, you can't have an I-thou relationship with the government or with the state, but you can with other people. And that impulse to interact with other people is part of the philanthropic impulse is part of that. That idea that you recognize yourself in the other person and you empathize with them. And that kind of empathy is something that you don't get in the market and you don't get in government.
Right. So something is puzzling. Philanthropy is good for the giver for the variety of reasons you've mentioned. Status makes you feel good. It's good for the recipient who needs the help. It's good for the society because in many ways, philanthropy is also an investment in the society, depending on where it goes. So why does it provoke suspicion and even hostility in every age, including our own?
Well, you prefaced all of those remarks by saying it's good for, and you really need to change that to it can be good for, because it can also be bad for. If you look at someone like Bill Gates, I mean, he's done immense good in the world. He has given more than anybody else, and in a huge variety of ways. If you take one example, he has promoted over 2.5 billion vaccinations against polio. And polio is a disease which used to cripple 1,000 children every day, and now is virtually eradicated throughout the world. It's been eradicated in India and lots of parts of Africa. There's a few places where it's not quite gone. But by and large, and that's a huge achievement, and that's just one of Gates's achievements. But if you look at his early experiments in education in the United States, he spent $2 billion on nearly 3,000 high schools, which had a million poor and ethnic minority students in them. And after a few years into the project, which is basically trying to make big schools into smaller schools, he decided this wasn't working. This whole approach was misconceived. And so the funding was abruptly ended. And some of the schools said, well, we haven't been given a chance to demonstrate whether this is going to work or not. And Gates said, no, we need a different approach. Now, to Gates, it was just a few lost billions. And it was a failed experiment. But to the kids who were in that educational process, those are lost years of education or prejudiced years of education, which they'd never get back. So the question is here's Gates doing good and bad, and I don't want to run Bill Gates down. He does mainly good, but this is an example of when you've got one individual with a lot of money and a lot of power, and he says, I'm going to spend it on this. How do we know whether the this is good or bad? And if it is bad, what are the consequences? Well, the Bill Gates Foundation has got three trustees, Bill, Melinda, and Warren Buffett. So as long as they're all on side, there's no one really to hold him to account. So this question of the relationship between democracy and philanthropy is a thorny one, because who are philanthropists accountable to? And that's where philanthropy can do bad as well as good. If you want to look at another example, you can look at the Koch brothers in the States. Well, David Koch died last year, but Charles Koch is still involved in kinds of philanthropy, which are about promoting small views of the state, deregulating the economy, scrapping environmental protections. And in the past, the Koch brothers have funded a lot of think tanks and academics who cast doubt on the reality of climate change. Now, there's some philanthropists doing something which actually goes against the thrust of modern science, goes against the thrust of what most democracies believe. And, you know, who holds them to account? So there's a downside as well as an upside to philanthropy.
Right. I guess in my mind, there's a distinction between donations that go to promote a particular political point of view and donations that go to the poor. And actually, even the poor is a question. There are different types and different definitions of poverty that dominated in different historical periods. I learned this from your book. So maybe you can talk a little about those different kinds of definitions of poor.
Sorry. I think it's worth saying at the outset, you say it's easier to look at, political donations by philanthropists and say, well, maybe that's not kind of the same as proper philanthropy. But, I mean, it's not as simple as that. Because if you look at the United States, which is the biggest philanthropic country in the world by far, four-fifths of the money that's given by rich people doesn't go to the poor. It goes to the universities they went to, the hospitals belonging to those universities, the schools that their kids go to, opera houses, which is where they like to spend their time. You know, the rich have different, very often, have different social, economic, and cultural views than everybody else. And so they put their money into that. And it's popularly thought that philanthropy is a transfer of money and resources from the rich to the poor. But in this case, it's from the rich to the rich. So we can see there's a question about that. And it's not just a question. You can't just answer it by saying, oh, well, you know, what a rich person does with their money is between, you know, them and their conscience, because there are systems of tax relief in most countries in the world. So if you give $100 million to an opera house and you're a taxpayer who pays 40% of their income in tax, that donation really only costs you $60 million, because the $40 million that you would have paid in tax is paid by the taxpayer. So the philanthropist is choosing to spend his money on opera rather than, say, local community sports, which the local people might prefer a sports field to an opera house. But the philanthropist makes the choice, and the local people's money, the taxpayers' money, goes with the philanthropist's choice because of the system of tax relief. So it's very complicated, and there is this democratic deficit with philanthropy. And the big question is how do you address that?
Right.
Now, so, a feeling I haven't answered the question you just asked me.
No, well, I mean, that's an important point, because philanthropy and government decisions about tax laws are intertwined. They're hard to tease apart. No one would object to a rich person building an opera house. It's the tax break that she gets from that. That's the problem. Is that right?
It is. And so then people come up with all kinds of solutions and say, well, maybe you should, you know, the government should say you get more tax relief if you give to a soup kitchen than if you give to an opera house. And there are lots of kind of proposals of reform of the tax system along those lines. But one of the other interviews in the book, which follows on from that one with the late Lord Sacks, is with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. And he says that the trouble is when you get, and he's quite a left liberal figure, Rowan Williams. But in when he looks at this question of the government deciding what the priorities of a philanthropist should be, he says the history of the last 100 years ought to tell us that a hyperactivist state with lots of moral convictions can be pretty bad for everybody. So the question of reform is prickly, because some reforms will have unintended bad consequences too. So it's a very complex area.
Yeah, it certainly is. We're in the middle of a global pandemic as we speak. Actually, the Wall Street Journal reported that philanthropy and volunteerism have increased and changed during COVID-19. You mentioned the Black Plague, which was a 14th century watershed in the relations between rich and poor and philanthropy. Tell us about that.
Well, the dominant vision of philanthropy in the 1,000 years from the 4th century to the 14th century in the Western world was pretty much governed by the relationship of the church and the state through Christendom. And although the medieval philanthropy was later disparaged at the Reformation, modern scholarship shows that it was pretty extensive, and it was done through the system of tithes, people paying a tenth of their or whatever proportion of their income to the church. It was done through organizations like confraternities and medieval guilds, which ran big charitable enterprises. Monasteries had the job of looking after the destitute, travelers. The whole idea of the hospital was derived from the monastic idea of the hostel, a place for pilgrims and travelers to stay. They educated orphans or put them into apprenticeships or what have you. There were huge bequests in wills from the growing merchant classes towards the end of that period, which were entirely philanthropic in their thrust. And then there was a lot of casual giving to beggars. So there was an ecology of charity and philanthropy which really governed that period. If you look as late as the 13th century, you get somebody like in France, King Louis IX. He was still personally washing the feet of the poor. So it wasn't something that was kind of just a theory. It was actually there in practice. And what happened with the Black Death was, I mean, it seems that the Black Death killed at least a third and perhaps even as much as a half of the population of Europe, and it changed the whole economic structure, because there was the same amount of land and fewer people to farm it, and peasants who'd been tied to the land were set free to look for better rates of pay elsewhere, and those who couldn't work there was like a tide of beggars swept the continent of Europe. And that changed, really, these vagrant beggars changed the attitude of the rich to the poor. Previously, there'd been this notion, which is kind of implicit in medieval theology, the idea of there was a cosmic relationship between, you know, God, you, and your fellow beings, which was Christianity inherited from Judaism. But although there was huge economic disparity between being rich and a peasant in medieval times, there was a more of a spiritual equality. The rich had a duty to help the poor, who were not in huge and overwhelming and threatening numbers, and the poor had a duty to pray for the rich. And the idea was that God would listen to the prayers of a poor man or woman better than a rich man, So therefore, if the poor were praying for you when you were rich, that was good. That was good for you spiritually. So there was a kind of mutuality, a reciprocity about it, which that went out of the window after the Black Death. And the rich began to look at the poor and think these people are a threat to social stability, and they might overthrow the government, and they might maraud through the land and steal stuff, which some of them did. And so there was this shift, and you went from the kind of Jewish vision of philanthropy back to the Greek one, which was really about social cement or social control. And with after the Black Death, you got almost, if you look at a country like England, almost every monarch from Henry VIII to Queen Victoria introduced a poor law or some other measure to control the poor. And that a notion that the poor needed to be reformed and controlled was central to Victorian charitable moralizing. And then it went through to a man like Andrew Carnegie, who was the richest man in the world in 1901 in America. And the vision of philanthropy that he shaped is pretty much the vision that's still with us today.
Which is philanthropy is a way to change behavior?
Which is a way that the morals and the worldview of those who are rich can be projected onto everybody else in a way which, I mean, Carnegie talked about his philanthropy was dedicated to creating ladders on which the aspiring poor could climb. That idea of social mobility, and that's fine. We're all in favour of social mobility, but it doesn't really help the people who are left behind at the bottom and who aren't mobile. So there was a sense in which there was a whole class of people who were abandoned by this kind of political vision. It arose out of the philosopher Herbert Spencer. He's not much heard of now, but he was the most famous person in philosophy in Victorian times. And he applied Darwin's theory of evolution to human society. In fact, it was Spencer, not Darwin, who invented the phrase survival of the fittest. And a lot of these really rich robber barons, they were called, because people like Andrew Carnegie, although we remember him as a man who did a lot of good, in his own time, he was an ambivalent figure because he made his money through pretty ruthless deals and some very questionable practices and exploiting his workers, cutting their wages constantly, even having strikes, sending private armies in to bust one strike, which killed some of the strikers. So he was, he was a philanthropist, but he was also this ruthless capitalist. And so Carnegie thought that this social Darwinism of Herbert Spencer meant that people like him, the rich, the bosses, they were innately superior human beings to the poor. And so it was better that they should make all the decisions about how everything should be done. So this kind of top-down model of philanthropy, which Carnegie instituted and shifted it away from like soup kitchens and giving to the poor and putting it into cultural infrastructure. He built 3,000 libraries all around the world, parks, art galleries, museums, concert halls. And so the model of philanthropy is less about what it was in that original Jewish vision, or as it was established in the idea of Christian charity through the Middle Ages.
Carnegie is the poster boy for what you mentioned earlier, people who laundered their reputation through philanthropy. Absolutely. But
said, he did a lot of good as well. So it's part of that ambivalence about philanthropy.
The character Tevye in the play and the movie Fiddler on the Roof has a wonderful line that says, "It's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either." When and how did the shame-faced poor emerge in the philanthropic mind?
There have always been distinctions made between different groups of the poor. I mean, if you look into the Hebrew Bible, you see, the focus on the widow, the orphan, the stranger. That is right from the outset. There's a selection on, certain kinds of poor as being the people who most deserved help. If you look at the Christian fathers, the church fathers, like in the third, fourth centuries onwards, they were concerned about, you know, if you've only got a certain amount of money, how do you prioritize who you give it to? And they came up with different solutions. I mean, the classical fathers, the Romans, the Stoics, they came up with lots of ideas about a kind of concentric circle around you. So you had a duty to, first of all, to your father, and then to your children, and then to your extended family, and then to your neighbors, and then to your nation, and out to the world like that. That you've got other ideas. No, you should prioritize those who are the genuine poorest. And in doing this, what emerged first in a kind of straightforward idea of trying to prioritize, but later with a kind of moral tinge over it of disapproving of certain groups of people, you'd get in Elizabethan times in England, for instance, there was a man called Thomas Harman, who is mentioned in my book, and he came up with a book in which he classified 24 different categories of poor, destitute, and beggars, and fraudsters, and people of whom you should be suspicious. So you get this idea that there's a kind of deserving poor and an undeserving poor, and some of those distinctions over which is deserving and which is not are more coloured by the political and economic prejudices of those in power than they are by what you might call any objective standards.
And does the concept that Michael Sandel mentioned in our interview and in his book of luck egalitarianism come into play? In other words, the worthy poor are those who couldn't help it. The widows, for example, or the elderly or disabled people, or the working poor who generally just get by, but when something happens, a turn down in trade or in the market or in their own health and family, they fall below sustenance level, as opposed to other kinds of poor people who maybe have addictions that are preventing them from earning a living. Is that the kind of worthy and unworthiness that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, you've indicated there some different categories, but there are many more different categories. And in historical terms, people would talk about the idle, the drunken and the indolent. The idea was these were people who could work but wouldn't work, found it more lucrative to go around being a beggar or even a con man and a fraudster. And so you needed, throughout most of those poor laws in English history, you see that it was a two-handed approach, cracking down on the villains and helping the really poor. The problem with this is that it's very difficult sometimes to distinguish who should be in what category. And if somebody is an addict, you have sympathy for them because they're in the grip of an addiction, but you also feel, well, they should never have got into that situation in the first place, so it's their own fault. And so where do you draw the line between these two impulses? And I think the answer is you draw the line in different places according to different individual circumstances. So it becomes a lot more complicated. And one of the problems with the kind of attitudes of the poor historically that you were referring to, is that there isn't really this kind of complexity. It's very binary. It's black and white. You know, they're either good or bad. They're either deserving or they're undeserving. But it's possible that both of those can be true, and that the solution is not either to give them money or to lock them up, but something in between. And it might be to do with changing the social circumstances which shape the problems that they are trapped in. So there's a variety of responses. And it's been too common for people in the history of philanthropy to just see it as black and white.
Of course, we've been talking about philanthropy in the West, in Europe and in America. Is there a dramatic difference in the approach to philanthropy in non-Western countries?
Yeah, I don't deal with this in great detail in the book because the book is big enough just dealing with Western philanthropy. I started off trying to write a book about English philanthropy and realized you couldn't do that. You had to go back to the Greeks and the Jews in ancient times, and you had to go forward to a world which is globalized and interconnected in a way which it's impossible to single out English philanthropy, but even then you're dealing with Western philanthropy. I've got some references to what happens in primitive societies, also in China and in India. But those, you know, you'd have to write a whole new other book about those, and it would take another 6 years, which is what it took to write this one. But I mean, it's interesting when you see a clash between these different approaches. So you get someone like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. They came up with this idea of the giving pledge, that everybody who was a billionaire should be persuaded to sign this pledge, which would mean that they would give away at least half of their money during their life or before they died or as part of their will. He moved around the Western world signing people up to this. But when he got to India and to China, he found that there were cultural barriers to it, and the idea of that there were different ideas about who you should give to first, in what ways you gave, what was the priority of giving, the hierarchy of giving. And the first time he went to India to promote this idea, he found that all the big billionaires said, "Oh no, we're busy. We're watching a cricket match or something. We can't come to that." And he had to work hard with a sympathetic Indian billionaire to try and inject the idea of philanthropy into the existing Indian worldview of charity. And you do see clashes and contradictions and tensions. Not so much contradictions, but tensions. Who do you give to? And you look at modern China, you know, a lot of the philanthropy of modern Chinese businessmen is actually controlled or endorsed by the Communist Party. And so it's got a political dimension too. You know, we give to this, but we don't give to that. Well, why? Who decides? And who influences?
Well, that brings us back to the state issue and the powerful role of the state. Besides the tax laws that we talked about earlier, nowadays in England and Europe and other places, the state has taken on most of the responsibility for caring for the poor, for the elderly, and for the disabled. How did that change the focus of philanthropy? Or did it?
Well, it did, definitely. I mean, I charted in the book the tensions in Victorian philanthropy between those who saw the poor as to blame for their own poverty and in need of moral reform, and those who saw them just as people who needed the symptoms of the worst aspects of their lives alleviating. There was that kind of tension. But what was happening, and this is focused very much in England during the Industrial Revolution, which kind of changed the world in lots of ways, you found that with the growth of those big industrial cities, that poverty was on a different scale and of a different nature than it had been. You know, medieval times, you'd have a poor person in the village, you'd all know about him, you would look after him in the way that, you know, in the 1950s, I went to rural Ireland and there would be like, you know, somebody who had a mental health problem would be just looked after by the rest of the community, and they would buy him drinks in the pub, and they would indulge him when he was being, you know, antisocial. When you get into a big industrial city, all that kind of human community tolerance goes, and you just start to see problems on a huge scale. And of course, the scale did increase because of industrialization. And there came to be a kind of realization amongst philanthropists of different kind of dispensations that they could never solve this problem. It was too big, and it needed to hand over to the state. And you see the start of that, the formation of the welfare state in the 1920s in England with the Liberal government, Lloyd George and so on. And they introduced a whole range of payments for people in difficulties, old age pensions, child benefit pensions, all that kind of thing. And And that went through in Britain up to the Second World War, when you got the foundation of the welfare state after with the Attlee government after World War II. And you saw in that an interesting interchange between the state paying for things, taking over things, and starting to have views on things which were quite kind of dictatorial, and the volunteers who'd run the hospitals and so forth throughout. And there was this kind of interweaving between volunteers and state operators who, in that period, the state came more and more to control these things. But at the end of the 20th century, it began to be seen that there were deficits in what the state could do. And people like Margaret Thatcher started to try and use charities to do some of the work of the state. And that had good and bad effects on charities, because it meant the government started to control charities too. But there emerged this sense that the state couldn't do everything, and also it had blind spots. It wouldn't do certain things, and so that's where the third sector, the third leg in society, needs to kind of be bolstered, because it has an alternative view to the government, and it has an alternative strategy and tactics than the market does. And so you then began to see a shift away from the idea that the state could do everything into a more tripartite view of the world, which is what you've got today. And so, I mean, one of the great examples that one philanthropist said to me was, you know, even if you have the best health care system in the world, who's going to pay for the clowns to go into the children's ward? And there's a very good line from Pope Benedict on this. He said, even in the most just society, there will still be loneliness. And loneliness can only be cured by love and charity, not by the state and political strategies. So there's been an increasing realization that the state has a role to play in all of this, but it's not sufficient.
And the state, of course, has made enormous mistakes in trying to intervene in issues of poverty and social justice. It's not just the big donors like the Bill Gates who tried a project and then stopped it without consultation. The state actually has done it as well. We can look at housing issues. We can look at educational issues. So errors on a large scale are in both parts of the society.
Yeah, errors are endemic to the human condition. Everybody yes. will always make errors all the time. And so what you need in a society are mechanisms which can swing the pendulum, or which can correct those errors. And if the state is inadequate in its provisions, or over generous in its provisions, or creates dependency, you're bound to get these different political views, which will say what we need is to be tougher on the poor, or what we need is to be more generous to the poor. And the poverty is a complex phenomenon, and there are elements where it's people. You know, you cannot just hand everything over to people. You've got to nurture a sense of self-respect and responsibility, personal responsibility in them, and striking the balance between those two. That's the task of politics and philanthropy.
And what should the philanthrocapitalists do? What should those mega donors do? The fact that they want to make a difference and have big visions and deep pockets are terrific. How can they do it better?
Well, the philanthrocapitalist approach is very much distinguished by the idea that you can bring business methods into philanthropy. So they bring this, the approach that's made them billions in high-tech industries in California or wherever, to philanthropy, and that has got both a good and a bad side. They bring this idea of strategic thinking, setting clear goals, developing sound evidence-based strategies, using innovative business techniques, measuring progress along the way, correcting course if you're not achieving the right impact. It's all very data-driven. It's metrics-obsessed. And you get someone like Bill Gates, who's also in love with technology, and you get in that kind of view, the idea that the rich person can look down on the problem and say, I know what the problem is, I'll sort this out. The downside with that is illustrated by Bill's wife, Melinda, who has taught Bill over the years that having the most fantastic solution is no good if people won't adopt it. You have to talk to people. You have to find out what people want. You have to find out what the barriers are to why they don't want to use this vaccine or why they can't get their sex workers can't get their clients to use condoms. You can't just tell them to do it. You've got to find out why they don't do it. And in the case in India, when Bill wanted to use a large-scale distribution of condoms to solve the problem of AIDS, which is at that point confined pretty much to sex workers and the trucker population, Melinda went to talk to the sex workers and found that all the ideas that Bill had wouldn't work because there was a problem of violence between the men and the prostitutes, which had to be addressed first. You can't ask somebody to insist on someone using a condom if they're threatening to beat you up anyway. So what the philanthrocapitalists have to learn is that they've got to listen to the people on the ground who understand what the problems are. And instead of looking at something and say, that's a problem, I have a solution, they need to think, no, these are people who I want to help. How do I do that? Well, by listening to them first. So the whole idea of listening, of entering into a partnership with people, treating them with respect, building mutual respect, and it's a two-way process. Both sides listen. When philanthropists do that, they move into this what I call reciprocal philanthropy rather than the philanthrocapitalist model of strategic philanthropy. And what I say you're doing there is that you're restoring the balance between the Jewish and the Greek models of philanthropy, the idea that you're balancing the clear vision of the strategic with the empathy of this more human approach. It's like, you know, balancing head and heart. And so that's why the book starts with and dwells with these philosophical areas, the Greek and the Jewish, because that has been lost in modern philanthropy, and some sense of balance between those two is what modern philanthropy needs.
You spent 6 years researching and writing this book, and it is a magnum opus. It's really an experience to read. I can't imagine what it was like to write, and it's very readable as well. How did it change you? What happened to you during those 6 years as you made your way through the history and world of philanthropy?
Well, the great formative experience of my life was going to cover the Ethiopian famine in 1985 when I was a young journalist. And, I mean, your eyes are open just by the baseline on which people live in those African societies. So when you get famine on top of it, you know, it's a shocking and horrifying realization. And I came to see as I moved from Ethiopia to Sudan and Chad and Niger and Mali, right across the Sahara, the sub-Saharan region, that the same problems were there everywhere. So it wasn't just a question of there being a drought and that had caused the famine. The people were trapped in systems of trading with rich countries, which on terms which were biased in favor of the rich. They've been saddled with large debts by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and those organizations have said the way to repay these debts is to implement policies which, in practice, harm the poor. So I suddenly realized this wasn't about just sending them money to try and feed them for the day. It was about justice. It was back to that Jewish notion of justice and charity being part of the same thing. And justice was what was needed to change things. And I worked like for 3 decades with Bob Geldof and Bono and others on campaigning to get some of these social justice issues onto the agenda of governments, and we succeeded in that to a certain extent with the Glen Eagles G8 summit. And so when I started to realize that philanthropy was a big thing, it was growing, you know, over the past two decades, three quarters of the world's philanthropy foundations have been founded in just those 20 years. And the Gates Foundation has a bigger budget now than 70% of the world's nations.
Extraordinary.
It's absolutely extraordinary. And at the beginning of the 21st century, the flow of cash from philanthropists to the developing world was tiny, didn't even warrant a separate entry in the statistics for the OECD. By 2011, it had made its way onto the OECD figures as a separate item. And by 2018, the OECD was declaring that philanthropy was reshaping the development landscape like never before. And I discovered that these people controlled between them more than $1.5 trillion. And so it occurred to me that the whole of my story, my life journey on this, had been about understanding the shift from charity to justice. And now here we were slipping back from justice to charity. And I thought, this doesn't sound right. And so I started with a more critical view of philanthropy, thinking, you know, how can this phenomenon be growing when it runs against the grain of history? And the 6 years in which I researched it, I came to a much more sophisticated view in which I realized that philanthropy had a huge advantage and a really good side, as well as a downside. And so I decided what was needed was not to write a kind of political book which said, you know, why philanthropy is bad, why justice is good, but to write something which says, you know, philanthropy is here, it can be good, and how do we make it better? So the book is really trying to learn the lessons of 2,000 years of where philanthropy has been good and where it has had failings, and how we can strengthen it today.
Well, finally, Paul, you've said where you'd like to see philanthropy going. What do you see? What do you foresee the future of philanthropy being?
Well, it could be one of two things. It could just, after the pandemic, it could go back to business as usual, and we could have philanthropy playing its part as the kind of social cement of the vision of the rich. And that's all bound up with globalization, growing inequality in various countries around the world. Or we could see some of the stuff that we've been honoured to see during the pandemic, of people helping one another, mutual aid groups being formed, you know, in all over Europe, all over the world. There have been groups of people setting out to try and assist the weak in their society, the vulnerable, to just collecting medicines and delivering them, collecting food. There's been a rise of kind of a sense of mutual solidarity, that we're all bound together, as the Africans say, Ubuntu. I am me because you are you. That there's a growth of that, and my hope would be that will be what will triumph. And I think if philanthropists read this book, they will see the advantages of using the heart as well as the head, of this reciprocal philanthropy, this mutual respect, this partnership, and that philanthropy can play a real part in, as the phrase has, building back better after the pandemic.
I agree, and I very much hope so as well. Paul, I've enjoyed our conversation, and I really learned a great deal from your book. Thank you for your time and for your extraordinary work.
It's been really interesting. Thank you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. Bye-bye.